Well, the Torah writing project is going well. I looked at the word count on my word processor, and I've almost typed 30,000 words, and I've barely squeezed out of Genesis chapter 1. But I know it's going to pick up the pace. It's going to speed up a bit as we go, because one of the things I've discovered from studying the Torah over so many years is that, you know, you've been to a fireworks display and you see the rocket go up and then it explodes. Well, think of how that explosion works. At that first moment of explosion, all the sparks, all the lights are right there in one little small bundle. They're all there, but they're all compressed together. A split second later, they've moved further apart and then further apart. And then further apart, and then when it's finally exploded, you can see every little individual spark by itself. But right at the beginning, they're all right there in a cluster. And I'm convinced that every major theme in the scriptures, every single one, is found right here in the opening words of the Bible, and the opening words of Genesis, in the first chapter even. But the thing is, they're so compressed, they're so squeezed together, and they only reveal themselves often in the Hebrew. So what we're going to do is we're going to start in chapter 1, verse 26. I'm going to read up through chapter 2, verse 4. But I'm going to try to discover and share those things with you that might not be so apparent at a casual read. So here we go, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. They shall rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and over the animal, the whole earth, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created Ha'adam, the Adam, in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them. I'd love to know what the words of that blessing were. I would just love to know. Maybe it's the same words we do with the Aaronic blessing, which happens to be in this week's Torah portion. I don't know. But God blessed them, and God said to them, and they're the first recorded words God speaks to Adam. "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea, the bird of the sky, and every living thing that moves on the earth." God said, "Behold, I have given to you all herbage yielding seed that is on the surface of the entire earth, and every tree that has seed yielding fruit. It shall be yours for food. And to every beast of the earth, to every bird of the sky, and to everything that moves on the earth within which there is a living soul, every green herb is for food." And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heaven and the earth were finished in all their array. By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done. And he abstained on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because on it he abstained from all his work which God created to make. These are the products of the generations, toldot is the word, these are the generations of the heaven and the earth, when they were created, on the day that Adonai God made earth and heaven. And that is the first time God's four-letter name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, appears in the Bible. Adonai God made earth and heaven. So, familiar words, but let's look at that opening passage. And Elohim said, "Let us make an Adam." Now, there are two words for man that are predominantly used in the scriptures. Actually, more than two, but two that are used the most. Ish is one of them, and we'll see that coming up later in the future study. And the other word is the word Adam. Now, we know that the first man was named Adam, but the word Adam is simply a word for a man. It's better translated as a human being, because the word Adam can apply to a female or a male. So let us make an Adam in our Zelem. Zelem is the word, in our image, according to our Damut, our likeness. And let them rule over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the sky, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. And Elohim created the Adam in his own Zelem. In the Zelem of Elohim, he created him, male and female, he created them. And there should be an extra T there in Zelem. There we go. Now, when you read this portion, if you take your time and think about it, there are two what you might call inconsistencies here. Two things that should draw your attention and say, wait, but that seems odd. Now, one of the things I've helped you with, I've put in bold type the words Zelem and Damut. Initially, God says, let's make the Adam, make the man in our Zelem and according to our Damut. But then it goes on to say twice that man was made in God's Zelem, but doesn't say he was made in his Damut. That seems kind of odd. And the other one has to do with, is it he, she, or them? Because God said, let us make an Adam. Now that's singular, right? In our image, according to our Damut, and let them, wait a minute, now it's turned to plural. And in the Hebrew, it's plural. Over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the sky, the cattle, and Elohim created the Adam, there it's singular again, in his own Zelem, and Zelem of Elohim, he created him, singular. Male and female, he created them, plural. It keeps jumping back and forth between the singular and the plural, singular, plural. It's like, decide on one or the other. This is not good literary practice here. All right. If you turn this in a literature class, it'd get all marked up for inconsistency in the number of people, whether it's singular or plural. So we see two inconsistencies here, but there are messages contained in these words, powerful and important messages. I'm going to start with the word Zelem and Damut. This word Zelem, and you can see it there in the Hebrew, it comes from the word Zel. The first two letters spell the word Zel. The word Zel means shadow. Remember Bezalel, the man God appointed to oversee the building of the tabernacle, Bezalel. It means in the Zel, in the shadow of Elohim, in the shadow of God. In modern Hebrew, a Zolah is a photographer. And it's spelled exactly like Zela, which is an image or a copy. So we see this word, which means something visible, something you can see. And a Xerox copy is called a Zela. It's a copy, it's an image, an exact reproduction of something else. So God says, let's make man in our Zela. Now here's a problem. The word emphasizes that God is not physical. He's spiritual. Not only that, he's invisible. So how can you make an image of something that you can't see? You see, when a painter, a portrait artist, makes a portrait, he looks at a person, a physical person he can see, and then he creates a physical image that you can see, a physical image of the physical person. But God is making a physical image of an invisible person. In fact, the only image of God that exists is the human being. And all the images of God that exist are all very flawed. All of us are flawed. We bear his image, but it's a flawed image. But fortunately, there was one human being who bore God's image perfectly. And who was that, of course? Yeshua. Yeah, no flaws there. So, when we think of us as being an image of God, it doesn't mean God has no meat hooks on the ends of his arms, with fingers and fingernails and bones. He's not physical. He doesn't have any of the stuff that you see. This is an image of invisible powers and principles and attributes of spiritual things. You have to remember that this that you see him holding up here is not a hand. We call it a hand. It is not a hand. It is a physical image of the one true hand. You follow? And when the word refers to God's right hand, I look at this, and if I know how to look at this, I can glimpse what it represents of God spiritually, the invisible spiritual God that I cannot see. It talks about God's throne, where he sits. It talks about the earth being his footstool. I have news for you. God does not have feet. Actually, he's the only one who does. But these things, the pins of my legs, aren't really feet. They are physical meat images of feet that I can't see. Without this image to help me understand. Now, this is tough stuff. This means we have to completely rethink. But let me just give you a few things. I know I've often done this, but there could be books written about this, and some have been, about how every detail about the human being, the human body, pictures some invisible attribute of our Creator. For one, and I love this one, I always start with this. Your body is made with balance. Could you imagine what it would be like if when a baby was born, you could never tell anything about what it looked like? Oh, how many legs did your child have? Mine came out with 5. He takes after his father. He had 5. It runs in his side of the family. Oh, our family, they all just come out with 1. They hop. Boy, they can hop. How many arms did your child have? Oh, he had 2 arms. Well, that's unusual. Usually people have at least 3 or 4. I mean, you can usually predict 2 legs, 2 arms, 1 head, right? 5 fingers on each hand. That's pretty standard, okay? That's pretty traditional when it comes to human births. But God has made us with balance. We're all unique and individual, but he's made us with balance. Left side like the right side. What do we learn from this? We learn that God's a balanced God. Now, God doesn't have physical legs. He doesn't have to walk. But he operates in balance. Paul says, behold the mercy and severity of God. He knows exactly when to be severe and when to be merciful. He has perfect balance. He knows when to be forceful and impose his will. We see Yeshua driving money changers out of the temple. But God's also humble. He knows when to speak. He knows when to be quiet. And Yeshua, the perfect image of God, he's a what? He's a lion and he's a lamb. You know, someone sent me a question about conversing with a friend of theirs. And this friend is very much a pacifist because they see Jesus as being a pacifist. And what they're not realizing is God is in balance, and therefore Messiah is in balance. And there were times he was a pacifist. But then you read Revelation 19, he comes back to judge the earth, comes back with a sword, wearing a garment dipped in blood. He comes back to kick Tukas when he comes. He's a lion, he's a lamb. But there's his balance. He knows when to operate as one and when to operate as the other. This is why he could premeditate violence in the temple with a whip of cords and drive out the money changers. And next moment, we see him there embracing little children on his knee and blessing them. We need to learn to walk in balance. If we do not walk in balance, we probably will not walk at all. We'll go around in circles is what we'll do. We must learn how to operate in balance in all things that we do. We need to see with balance and hear with balance and work in balance and walk in balance. Not compromise, balance. Balance. And that's an important principle to learn. Carla, I see a hand up. Do we have a microphone over here for Carla? Did we put mics off today? Yep. Oh, right. And welcome home, Brian, from your world travels. It's great to have you back where you belong. There we go. Okay, Carla, yes.
balance doesn't have to do with tension between the two extremes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yes. Yes, tension. There's always tension involved in balance. This is why extremes are comfortable and easy. And we find extremes everywhere in the world, and we find extremes everywhere in the religious world. Some people are extremely legalistic. That's easy. With the legalism, I don't have to think. I just follow the rules. Or, on the other hand, I can be totally unlegalistic. I can just be everything, la-di-da-di-da-da-da, whatever I feel like doing, that's what goes. You don't have to think in that extreme either. But when you realize God has rules for me to live by, but by the same token, I need to know which ones are more important. I need to know when I have to put to fulfill this commandment, this one has to be set aside. I'm to keep the Sabbath, but my neighbor's ox is in a ditch. Sabbath set aside. I have to help him. You know, and there's a sensitivity to God and to others and how to fulfill the commandments. We have to walk in this tension between the two. And that's where freedom is. That's where being a human being is. And you find this constantly, all the time. All the time. I find myself wanting to be a lion when I should be a lamb, wanting to talk when I should be quiet, wanting to be a pacifist when I need to act, and knowing when to do which. There's this tension always going on. And hopefully, just as a child is always taking a step and falling, taking a step and falling, and taking two steps before they fall, hopefully we get better with practice. And so we don't fall so often. But remember what it says about a righteous man. A righteous man falls seven times, and he gets back up seven times. Okay? We keep getting better. That's the goal. Another thing. God placed a sense of sight, hearing, smell, and taste all in this thing on top of my shoulders in the head. And the brain is in there too. Believe it or not, there's a brain in there. This controls everything from the neck down. And everything from the neck down must follow what's above the neck, must follow the head. But there are five sensitivities. There's one more sensitivity. It's the only one the body has. The body is deaf, dumb, and blind, but it has feelings. It can feel. It can touch. It can feel things. Now, Yeshua is called the head of the body. We're part of the body, which means we're blind, deaf, and dumb. But boy, we can go by our feelings if we want. So you have a choice as part of the body of Messiah. Live by your feelings or live by the head. Trust what the head sees, what the head knows, and listen to it. Let it communicate to you in an internal way. When I move my hand, I do not have to speak with my lips to my hand to make it do something. Hand, rise. Hand, go down. I don't have to do that. There's an internal silent connection. Watch that. See that? I'm making that happen. I'm not moving my lips either. Right? Okay? There's this internal connection. Do you have that with the head? And it's not feeling. It has nothing to do with emotions. It has nothing to do with feeling. It's a spiritual, deep, real connection. And a lot of people who don't have that substitute feelings in its place. They think they're following the spirit. All they're following is an emotion. And this is a tough thing that takes maturity. Sometimes it takes a lot of embarrassment and failures before you begin to recognize what is truly spiritual, what's just emotion. And here's a very practical application of this. Let me ask you a question. When do you find yourself most worried, most fearful? When do the dark imaginations arise most in your mind? When you're upright in the day and working, or at night when you're laying on the bed, supposed to be sleeping? It's always at night, isn't it? That's when the terrors hit. And the rabbis address this. They say the head must rule the heart. The head must be above the heart. But when we lay down, what happens? They're on the same level. And what's taking place physically also takes place spiritually. So when you're laying down physically, that the heart can begin to rule the head. We forget what we know is true, and then the feelings, the emotions, the impressions begin to rule, and we become frightened and fearful and worrisome. What's the solution? Stand up. Get out of bed. Put your head above your heart. Walk. Begin to engage reality again. Begin to quote what the word says. Remind yourself of what is true. And once your head is ruling your heart, then go lay down again. You understand? It's very real stuff. It really is. It's very real stuff. Another thing. There are parts of the body that are exposed. You got your head, your arms, your legs, your feet, your hands. But much of the body is hidden. The lungs, the heart, the bones, the circulatory system, those things are completely invisible and out of sight. Likewise, with God, there's part of him he reveals and much of him he conceals. In Deuteronomy 29:29, it says, the hidden things belong to God, but the revealed things belong to us and to our children forever. Why? So we can obey the Torah of the Lord. Okay? So there's part of God's concealed, part that's revealed. But what is the part of the body that most expresses what's hidden inside? What expresses your emotions, your feelings, what is it? It's your face. You know, what do we put on our money? The faces of presidents. We don't put their kneecaps or their foot. Oh, there's George Washington's foot on the $1 bill. No, we put his face there. That's how we recognize people. Because unlike the animals, our faces can express what's inside. You can almost tell what a person's thinking if you can read a face. And so we are told to seek God's what? His face. So many times we seek his hands. We want him to do. But he said, no, seek his face. Nobody's thinking. Learn to read what he is thinking at the moment. What his intentions are for you at this moment. Learn to read his face. That's a tough thing, but that's what we're to seek. Yes, let's get a Tony a microphone over here. Oh, here he comes. Okay.
What I'm getting at out of this is also what I'm getting is God has created us in his image. It's an invisible image. He's put eternity in the hearts of men.
Yes.
That's what I'm getting at out of this message. He's put eternity in the hearts of men.
Yes, and Ecclesiastes says that. God's put eternity in their hearts. That's right. Very good. Thank you, Tony. Well, let's get on to the next word. He says, let's make man in our zelim and according to our demut. But then it says, he created his Adam in his own zelim. In the zelim of Elohim, he created him. Where's demut? Now, I'll give you a heads up. Later, I think it's around chapter 5, it does refer to the fact that God did make Adam in his demut, but it's not until then. What happens between here and there that began to change Adam and make Adam into God's likeness? Well, if you don't look at the Hebrew, this will pass you by. You won't see this at all. The word demut, there is what it looks like, is the word likeness. That's a good translation. But remember how the word Bereshit, the first word of Genesis, we'd slice it in different ways and these new meanings emerge? We're going to do the same thing with Demut. We're going to slice between the first and second letters. When we do that, this is what we get. These three letters, Mem, Vav, Tav, these spell the word death. Mut is death. Later we'll encounter Methuselah. And Methuselah comes to the word mut. Mut shelach is really how it's closer how it should be pronounced. Mut dying shelach. He will send. Methuselah. Mut shelach. Dying, he will send. What does that mean? Apparently there's a promise made at Methuselah's birth that when he dies, God would send judgment upon the earth. Was God in a hurry to send judgment on the earth? No. That's why Methuselah lived longer than any other human being. What was it, 900 and how many years? 969. And but the very year he died, the flood came. Again, you see the tension and the balance? God knew he was going to have to bring judgment on the earth. But he was so hesitant to do so that he allowed Methuselah to live 969 years before he brought it. Anyways, but mut means death. Now this letter is Dalet. The name of the letter, Dalet, that name means door. And you don't use the word of in Hebrew. It's always implied. So Dalet, mut, door of death. And we're going from right to left. To make man in God's image requires man to go through the door of death. And this is one of the most profound, pervasive principles in the Word of God. Now, we have to define death. When we think of death, don't think of a dead body in a funeral. Death means separation. A friendship can die. The two people still exist, but the friendship is gone because they've separated. A marriage can die. The two people exist, but they've separated. We say the daylight is dying. Does that mean there's no more daylight? No, it means that the sun's going down. The sun's still there. There's still light being given by the sun, but it's being separated from me. I'm left behind the part of the planet's dark while the sun's still over the other side of the planet where it's light. There's separation. Death means separation. That's just what it means, okay? So you have to think of death as separation. When you die, your soul and your body separate. Your body goes back to the dust and your soul goes back to its source. That's what death is. Okay? Separation. And there's no way in heaven or on earth where you can be made into God's likeness apart from death. Now, if you're thinking, oh, I can't be made in God's likeness till I die. No, it's, you know, when you, it's not just a matter of becoming dead. It's something more than that. Now, what I'm going to do is, like last week and in future weeks, I'm going to read a part of what I've written. Since I've taken so much time to write this, I might as well read some of it to you, huh? So, this is a rather lengthy section, but I think it will put it into words better than me just trying to figure them out on the wing here. So, here we go. It is possible to use a term so frequently that we come to think that we understand it. And I think that has happened with our use of the word cross. In Christianity, one often hears phrases such as the power of the cross, take up your cross, nail it to the cross, and others. We must cease thinking of the cross as merely a piece of wood upon which our Savior was executed. The cross, instead, is a principle, a way of life. The cross means that I choose to die to my ways and live for the sake of another's. It means I say no to myself and yes to God. It means that I do not have a right to myself, but I belong to another. It is living for the sake of another and not just for my own. This was gloriously demonstrated by Yeshua when he chose God's will instead of his own and stepped through the door of death out of love for God and for us. The principle of the cross is what is absolutely necessary for anyone who chooses to follow Messiah. He said, if anyone wishes to come after me. Now, what does it mean, by the way, to come after Yeshua? How can I go after Yeshua? I mean, he's not, where is he? I'll go after him, but point him out to me. How do you go after Yeshua? You try to become like him, likeness to Yeshua. He could just as easily said, if anyone wishes to be in my likeness. Anyone wishes to be like me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. In other words, you got to die. You have to step through the dalet mut, the door of death. This is what is meant by the cross. It is the principle by which Yeshua lived his life among us, and it is the principle by which we too are to live our lives in the world. But, by definition, living according to the principle of the cross requires a daily dying to one's own impulses. We cannot live according to the principle of the cross and still do things our way. To be made after God's likeness, we must willingly walk through this door of death. This is the cost of following God, but it is worth it. Yeshua continues, for whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever lets go of his life, that's death, for my sake, we'll find it. Death to oneself is necessary for anyone who wishes to be more like his Creator, because he himself is one who does all things for the sake of others and not for his own. Now, to illustrate what I'm talking about, I go on and I say, let's play a game called If I Were God. As the name implies, this game requires you to imagine that you are the creator. After having created the most incredible, beautiful, and luxurious world imaginable, it is time to populate it with creatures that will be enough like you that you can have a meaningful relationship with them. And they with you. So, how would you, as God, make these beings? You, as God, will have no difficulty understanding them, but how will they possibly begin to understand and relate to you? Let the game begin. First, you will need to give them activities and responsibilities that in some way reflect your own. So, as God, what kinds of things typify an average day? Well, you exercise free will. Check. You make decisions. Check. You are in authority over other beings. Check. Because what did God do? He put Adam in charge of what? All the animals, the fish, the birds, and the garden. You communicate your wishes to those under your authority. Check. Being in authority, what you say goes. And after all, remember how God brought the animals before Adam? And it says, whatever Adam named the animals, that was their name. God didn't say, oh, that rethink that one. That's not good. He didn't do that. Adam, these are under your authority. What do you call them? Perfect. That's their names. No argument. But let's go on. So far, we have a list of things that God gave Adam to do. However, there's also a problem here. This checklist also describes Satan. And you certainly don't want your creatures to resemble him. Right? So how do we make these free will entities, I'm not reading, I'm just talking, so they turn out better than the devil? Well, looking over history, you may think most of them haven't. But some have. So what is missing from the list? What is the thing? What's this thing you must include with Adam that will allow him to truly be in your likeness and relate with you and be like you? What quality about yourself do you wish to instill in your creatures so that they can truly be like you? Then it hits you. You are a giver, not a taker. Your every action up to this point has been one of giving without requiring anything in return. As God, you foresee that your creatures will disappoint you and cause you pain. You even foresee a time when you must make an ultimate sacrifice on behalf of your creation, and you're completely willing to pay such a high price. What is this thing that makes you willing to give life for life? What motivates you to choose the good of another over your own? What do we call it? It's called love. You know there is no love without death. You cannot love another person without the principle of death being involved. Because I love you, I really love you, there's going to come a point where either you get to have your way or I get to have mine. Right? And if I love you, I'm not concerned about you giving your life for me. I'm going to lay down my rights for you. There is no love without death to something. It just does not exist. And you get married, what do you die into? All the other women you could have dated. What are you dying to? Having a bedroom that might have pinks and lavenders in it instead of just all black and red, you know? I mean, there's all kinds of things you give up. Fortunately, we don't have a pink and lavender bedroom. So let me go on. You realize that love involves choice. Somehow, simply compelling your creatures to love you will not accomplish your purpose. Love must be a choice or it is not love. And it must be a choice that has a cost attached to it. And the greatest form of love is for one individual to lay down his life for another. For your created beings to truly be like you in this respect, death must not only be a possibility, it is a requirement, one that is chosen by the one who will die. In other words, there's only one way in this world that Adam can be made in God's likeness. Adam has to die, but Adam has to choose it. Then he's like God. Think about that for a second. I mean, are there a whole bunch of verses now coming to mind, like where Paul invites us to be living sacrifices, right? Living sacrifices. All the place talks about humbling yourself, about taking up your cross and following Yeshua, letting go of your life for his sake. I mean, really, this is a major theme in scriptures. And as I continue the ride just a little bit more, I say, I encourage you to continue to play this game as we study Genesis. I think it will give you a renewed appreciation for our Creator's great wisdom in doing things exactly as he has done. And it will help you see that every decision God makes is motivated by love for his creation. All right, that's a good place to stop. So let's review this. I want to make sure this is locked into our minds. We're already made in God's image. We got that. Hitler is made in God's image. But not all are made according to his dumb boot. Only those who have love for him and love for their neighbor are in God's likeness. But for love to really be love requires death. But there are two things about this death. First of all, you have to choose it. If someone else makes you dead, all you wind up is dead. But you must choose to die to your own ways, to your own self. Maybe even to the point of physically giving up your life so that others can live. Looking at someone and saying, I love you so much. I'm willing for my existence in this world to come to an end now so that your existence can continue. There's greater love, no greater love than that, Yeshua says. But there's a problem with that when we stop there. Because just dying for the sake of another isn't enough. Because what does Paul say? 1 Corinthians 13. If I give my body to be burned, in other words, I give my body as a martyr and I don't have love, it profits me nothing. It's a big zero. So there has to be love in this. Which makes you ask, well, why would anybody give up their life for someone else without love? Self-interest. And here's the real kicker, folks. If you decide, yes, I'm going to die and live for the Lord, and you're doing it out of self-motivation, out of self-interest, because, yes, this is where the blessing is, and I want blessed, so I'm going to do it. You're still not letting go of your life. You're just looking for a way of making it better. I'm telling you what, you have to get to the place where you get so disgusted with you, so fed up with you, so tired of carrying around your carcass of you, that you just want it all to end. And say, God, take it. I'm so fed up with me. And I realize only you are the source of life. So you've chased me down. I'm tired of running. Take it. It's this heart spark of motivation of why you want to give your life to God that makes all the difference. There are a gazillion people giving their hearts to God, and they're still as selfish and proud and egotistical, even more so than they were before. God wants the people who are totally done. They're totally done. They're not looking to trade in their life on a new model. They just want to unload their lives altogether. They truly want to die. But they're going to do it in the way where they're giving their lives back to the one who purchased them. You're not your own. You're bought with a price. You're fine saying, God, forgive me. I'm so tired of taking the life you've given me and living it my way. I've made a wreck of it. I don't want it anymore. You can have it back. And from now on, whatever life looks like, whatever my days are, however many I have, They're yours. I'm your bondservant now. I'm giving my freedoms up. They're all yours. So you do with me whatever you want. Now that is a person who's going to begin to experience a really new life. But you've got to come to that point where it doesn't work. That's the battery you put in the circuitry that makes it all work. And if you're not there yet, you can't make it happen. You can start. You can do the best you can with the bit of disgust for yourself you have now. Take that little bit of disgust you have for you and start to die and start to give your life away. But there needs to come a point in your life, finally, you're just done with it. And, you know, we all want to experience the resurrection, don't we? None of us want to experience the death. And this decision to finally, once and for all, to give your life to God is the toughest decision you ever make. It's the scariest thing you'll ever do. I promise you it is. You know, when you think of Yeshua going to the cross, and you look at that horrible, agonizing death that he died, experienced, I can't find, or if it's there, I haven't seen it. I just can't think what it is. It doesn't describe what he felt like. It says he thirsted. That's about as far as it goes. It doesn't talk about saying, oh, my feet hurt. Oh, my hands are killing me. You don't see any of that expression. The pain is not described. But you back up a few hours to the Garden of Gethsemane. There the agony is described. The pain he felt is described there. Because what is he going through? Father, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. That was the agonizing part. Nobody was persecuting him, that blood was coming out of his brow. He's sweating blood. That's how much pain he was in making this decision. But once the decision was made, he went to the cross with his head up. The rest was, I'm not going to say it was easy, but compared to that in the garden, it wasn't as tough because his mind is already made up. He'd already given his life away, so now it's done. You see what I'm saying? The decision itself to really mean business with God, to give your life away totally, every aspect of it, that's the scariest, toughest thing you'll probably ever do. And God may have to bring you to the very point where you're willing, literally, physically, to die before you do that. That may be what it takes for you. Some nuts are harder to crack than others. But there's no way for you to be like him until you go through this Dalet Mut, the door of death. It's not going to happen. Do you understand that? It's a powerful principle. It's found here, hidden in this passage of Scripture. Up to this point, we've seen separation, 3 days of separation, followed by 3 days of filling, right? God fills what he separates. Separation is death. We've seen death on day one, day two, and day three. Then we've seen life on days four, days five, and six. And here again, we see this. You have to die for life to take place. So what does Yeshua say? Unless a seed falls into the ground and dies, it splits open, it separates. There's no life, there's no fruit. This theme permeates the Bible. And yet we talk about the cross and dying to oneself as if we know what we're talking about. So I hope now you know what we're talking about. Okay? Now, there was a hand up somewhere, and I see Steve with the mic. Yes, right here, men. Thank you. Are we on? Do we have a microphone on up here? Is on now. There we go.
I was thinking about there was a few years ago, there was a tight friend of mine asking me questions about the image of God. And you talk about how, in our heart, you know, the reflection is on our face. And she asked me, why is it that some people have an evil heart? But yet he speaks good things. And that caused me to realize that when God made us in his image, this is before Adam and Eve sinned, there was a good thing in us. So even now, we have two things that are going on, good thing and the bad. Yeah. And that's when the mouth speaks.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out from an evil heart or a good heart.
Yes.
and surrendering ourselves, dying. I see that I still die every day.
Yeah.
I need to die every day,
yes,
so that my mouth will glorify Him and reflect His image. But that takes obedience. And
yeah, it does.
And I just say, it's we all should be thankful that someone that we don't even know are praying for us.
Yes.
Because for us to make that kind of decision, think about how many people are praying.
Oh, yes. Right, thank you. Yeah, too, ma'am. Thank you so much. While you're talking, I'm reminded of what Yeshua said. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments. What does love require now? Remember, what does love require? Death. A person's not willing to die to their own ways, they're not going to keep God's commandments. Or unless it makes them look better, unless it smells self-serving. What happens if keeping His commandments doesn't serve you? You won't keep them. It's only a person who truly loves God. Can they keep His commandments? All right. We've got to move on. We have a lot of material to cover yet. So how about this bit about, he's talking about he and then them, about the Adam and then the male and the female. What's going on? There's it may sound weird to you, but it's very scriptural. There's a concept in Judaism that when God created Adam originally, before Eve, Adam had both male and female attributes all together in one body. That sounds really odd and really strange, and today it would be. Yet, it lines up with Scripture. Now, if your Bible says, and we'll get to this in chapter 2, that God took one of Adam's ribs to make Eve, fix it. The word is not rib. The word there is zalem, I believe. And it's used 49 times at the Tanakh, but only two places do they translate it rib. Every other place, except where it's the name of a town, Zela, it means a side of something. A side, a whole side. God didn't just take a rib, some insignificant bone from Adam's body to make a bride. He took a whole side of Adam, right down through the middle. You follow? I think this whole ridiculous nonsense about Adam or Eve being made from a rib has really caused a lot of male superiority over women. God made me the whole body. Here's this little, take this bum. I don't need it. It's like an appendix. Who needs that? I'll make a woman out of that. No, I took half of Adam. Took a whole half of him, a whole side of him. And that's what he made Eve out of. You find this in the Talmud, that Adam and Eve were originally created back to back, after which God separated them so that they were able to turn and face each other. This is a scriptural principle. They were one flesh originally, but when God separated them, they could become one flesh again, but this time it was with choice. It was a much better oneness than before. And this principle, again, separating, that's death, isn't it? It says, Adonai Elohim caused a deep sleep, a tardema. It's only used two times in Scripture. See if you can figure out where the other place is. God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. And he took one of his sides, closed up the flesh at that place, and Adonai Elohim fashioned to a woman the side, Hatzela, which he had taken from the man and brought her to him. Do you notice, too? I think it's kind of interesting. Remember the word for shadow is zel? There you find the word here as well. There's a theme going through here, but it's just like a zel. A shadow is part of a zelamut, an image. As the man is made the image of God, the woman also bears the image of the man and of God. Okay, so it's an interesting thing. Now, something else that's easy to miss is this. You may not have noticed this when you go through the 6 days of restoration, but day one is not called the first day. It's called Yom Echad, day one. Then the second day is called second day, and then third day, and fourth day, and fifth day. When you get to the sixth day, it's the sixth day. It's the only one of the six that contains the definite article, the. Now, the rabbis catch all these things, and they may or may not come through in your English translations, but they're obvious in the Hebrew if you look for them. So let's address these two, some interesting insights here. When you take the word Yom Echad up here, that can also be translated the day of the one. The day of the one. What does that mean? The day of the one. Who is the one? God is the one. We say in the Shema, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord, Adonai Echad." The Lord is Echad. He's the one. In Isaiah 45, over and over, God says, I am He. I am Adonai. Besides me, there's nothing else. In other words, I'm the one. He's the one with which we have to do. So Yom Echad can mean the day of the one. Well, what existed on the first day? Light. Light. And then God separated darkness and light. He created the darkness, but separated from the light. But God dwells in both. It says several times he dwells in the thick darkness. There's no darkness in him, but he can dwell in the darkness. But he is light. So Yom Echad, the day of the one, is the day of light. When darkness doesn't exist, darkness is separated. That's the day of the one. Well, with that in mind, when you look at the verses describe the day of the Lord in the future, it describes a day where there's no night. Describes a time when it's all light. For example, you could look at Revelation 21, verses 3 and 4. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he shall dwell among them. They shall be his people. God himself shall be among them. He shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall no longer be any death. There shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away." And then it goes on a bit further in verses 23. "And the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God is illumined." On the first day, you didn't need the sun and moon. They came around on day four. Well, that first day, you had light. The sun and moon were unnecessary. "For the glory of God is illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb, and the nation shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory unto it. And in the daytime, for there shall be no night there, its gate shall never be closed." And it goes on and on. Talks about there's no need for the light of sun and so on. So it's the day of the one. So when you think of that day of the Lord, it's almost like God saying, go back, look at the very first day. And that's when light was revealed and as it permeated the universe. But how about the sixth day? Why does it say the sixth day, not just a sixth day? Well, let me read a comment by a rabbi, Rabbi Avraham Saba. He was born in 1440. That's even older than me, you know, 1440. So almost 600 years ago. This is what he says. He's commenting on this verse. He says, "I believe that we can detect an allusion to the ultimate redemption in the sixth millennium in the report about God's creativity on the day. All political power will pass to the Messiah. The Yom HaShishi, the sixth day, alludes to and symbolizes the day when God himself will rule exclusively, preside over the world, as described in Isaiah 2, quote, on that day, Adonai alone shall be exalted, and the idol shall vanish completely." So this rabbi from almost 600 years ago saw in this that it's in the sixth millennium, the one that we live in now, somewhere at the end of that, the Messiah will come and establish his kingdom, which begins the seventh millennium, the Sabbath millennium, the millennium of rest. That's pretty cool. Well, let's finish up with just a couple things. This is important, but we'll just go quickly. No more questions, all right? We're going to fly it through. Genesis 2:4. "These are the generations of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that Adonai Elohim made earth and heaven." This is the first appearance of God's name. In the verse in Hebrew, you can see it right there. But there are three things in this verse that are very interesting to me. First of all, is God's name appears for the first time. Second, you'll see here in the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth word, "Behibaram" is You see this one letter, the letter He? See it right there? It's real small. That's the way it's in every Torah scroll in the world. That letter He, and that word, and only in this occurrence of the word, does it appear small and raised up. Another interesting thing is the second word. It says, Ela toldot teshamayim v'haaretz. These are the generations. So the word generations is right there. And the spelling of the word, is normally not spelled that way. The word's used a bunch of times in the Tanakh, but only twice is it spelled that way. So I'm going to fly through these. We get to all three things, fine. If we don't, we'll just finish with what we have. First of all, I'm going to talk about God's name. Here's how it looks, and I separate it with dashes because it's just a sign of respect. And sometimes in Jewish books, when they use the word God, they'll put G-D. It's not because they don't like the word God. God's a perfectly good word. But when they put the dash in, they're saying they're using the word in reference to God's four-letter, holy, unpronounceable name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, is how it's spelled. This is called the Tetragrammaton, but we do not know how it's pronounced. I calculated, let me go to my book for a second. I calculated how many ways this word could be pronounced. Because here's the difficulty. This first letter, some people say it has a Y sound. Some say it has a J sound. This is why the King James Version is finding so many names that start with J. Jerusalem. This actually should be Yerushalayim. Jesus. Actually, Yeshua. Jacob. It should be Yaakov. Jeremiah. Should be Jeremiah. Because wherever they have a Y that's Yud, they make it a J sound for some crazy reason. But people argue about whether it should be a Y sound or a J sound. This, now these letters here, the second, fourth letter, always have a just sound like an H. No disagreement there. This Vav, this third letter, is a real troublemaker. Some say it's a V sound like a V. Some say it's a W sound. That's why some people spell God's name YHVH, and others spell it YHWH. And I have some books and things where they're teaching Hebrew, and it drives me crazy because they pronounce it like a W. And it kind of makes me bonkers. But the real problem is this. We don't know what the vowels are. You see all the dots and dashes here in the Hebrew? All these little dots and dashes above and below the letters, these are vowel symbols that were developed in the Middle Ages. They are not part of the original Torah. But they feared that people would forget how to pronounce the words of the Bible. So a man developed a system of vowel points. So if you know how to interpret these vowel points, you know where the vowels go in the words. Because Hebrew is all consonants. There are no vowels in Hebrew. So when you take all of that into consideration, two ways pronounce the Yud, two ways pronounce the Vav, what vowels go with these, and the Vav, not only can be a consonant, it can also be a vowel sound, an U or an O, or Vu or Vo, or Wo, Wu or Wo, or V, or We, or Va, or Wa. Now, who knows? So here's what it comes down to. If we ignore the W pronunciation for the Vav, I have calculated that there are 2,592 possible pronunciations of God's four-letter name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. 2,592. However, if we include the possible W pronunciation for Vav, the number expands to, are you ready for it, 15,552 possibilities. When someone tells you they know how to pronounce God's name, they do not know how to pronounce God's name. And then the question is, should we try to pronounce it at all anyway? That's a subject we'll leave for later time. But one thing you must realize is God's name is a verb. This is why I always say you pronounce God's name with your actions, not with your lips. You pronounce his name with your life, not with your mouth. He's a verb. See these three words here? This is the word for was, the word for is, and the word for will be. Do you notice something? They're all made of Yuds and Hays and Vavs. They're all made of the letters that make God's name. God's name is a verb. It's a form of the word to be. It can mean was and is and will be and all of them mixed together. It's a verb. It's a word of being. This is why we pronounce his name with our lives, with our beings, with our doings, with our actions, not with our mouths. It takes more than a spelling lesson to learn God's name. What's interesting is over later, about Exodus chapter 5, I think, where God speaks to Moses on Mount Sinai. He says, you know, Abraham and all those guys, they didn't know my name, Yahweh. Well, here's the problem. They didn't know the name Yahweh. But God says they didn't know my name. Why did God say that? God is saying that, Moses, you're going to see me in a way they never saw me. You're going to see me doing something in such a way that they never saw. I didn't reveal my name to them, but you're going to see it in action. You're going to understand what my name means. So Abraham could spell it. Enoch could spell it. Moses or Noah could spell it. But it wasn't until Moses that people understood it. People really had it revealed to them. God's name is more simple, or more, it's more complicated than a simple pronunciation. Now, the reason I bring this up is because what does it say? It says that God's name was revealed only after the Sabbath was instituted. And this is what we'll finish with. Let's go to the passage. Go to chapter 2. Verse 1, thus the heaven and the earth were finished, and all their array. By the seventh day, God had completed his work which he had done, and he abstained on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because on it he abstained from all his work. He shabbated from all his work which God created to make. These are the generations of the heaven and the earth when they were created on the day that Yahweh, God made earth and heaven. Notice God's name is not revealed for the first time in Scripture till after the Sabbath. What's the Sabbath all about? Rest. What's God's name all about? Action. But God does not give us his name, which is a verb, until he's introduced us to rest. Rest comes first. Then our God's name, which is a verb of doing an action, is finally revealed. In God's economy, rest precedes action. Stillness precedes activity. It's a powerful principle. And we can't afford to have that lost on us. Now remember how the first 3 days were days of separation, and then days 4, 5, and 6 were days of filling? Do you see any separation taking place on day 7? Do you see it? Thus the heaven and earth are finished, all the way by the seventh day God completed his work which he had done. He abstained on the seventh day from all the works he had done. God blessed the seventh day, and there it is. See that word sanctified? The word kadash means set it apart. He separated it from the other 6 days. So there's separation taking place. Well, there's separation. Is there a filling? Let's go on. Because in it he abstained, he rested. It may say on it he rested or on it he abstained, but in the Hebrew it can be translated in it he rested. He separated it from the other 6 days, and what did he fill it with? Himself. And then he reveals his name. This is amazing stuff. I hope you can appreciate the wisdom God is displaying here in these verses. If you want to know who God is, you have to rest. You need to embrace the Sabbath. If you want to be like him, you have to die. I've always found that people who resist the Sabbath are also the people, same people, who resist giving their lives to God. Yet people who are willing to die to themselves and make themselves living sacrifices, giving themselves to God, they have no problem embracing the seventh-day Sabbath. I've always found that. I didn't notice I noticed that until I saw it in the Scripture. I thought, you know what? There's a pattern here. People who are dead don't have any problem resting. People who died to themselves become like God. And so they have no problem resting on the Sabbath day, this day that is filled with him. this doer whose name is being and doing and actions, a verb. You get to know him when you're still. You really get to know him when you make yourself small. One of the things I put in the book is that sometimes to see God eye to eye, you have to get on your knees. When you're on your knees, you're on eye level with God. There's a powerful principle there. And we've gone way over time, so let's close. Our Father and King, thank you so much for the wonders that are in your Torah. Thank you so much for the wisdom that is there. I pray you continue to just to inspire our hearts and minds to seek your face through your Torah, that we might come to know you, be more like you. Help us to be more willing to lay down our rights, our ways, to deny ourselves, to humble ourselves, just to die to self, so that we can become more like you and experience the resurrection life of Messiah. Make us the people you want us to be, Father, regardless of the cost. And we ask it in Yeshua's name for the sake of his kingdom. Amen.